Welcome to the latest in Arch Insurance International's Pursuing Better Together podcast series. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Mark Gagan, editor at The Voice of Insurance, a podcast platform which, as Mark puts it himself, looks to re-examine and challenge long-held beliefs, received wisdom, and insurance myths and taboos by getting up close with many of the sector's leading practitioners. Mark is part of a rather exclusive club, and yet he is the only insurance journalist to have had a prior career transacting international insurance and reinsurance business. Previously an insurance and reinsurance broker working in London and Madrid, he became a sector journalist in 2005 before joining the highly respected market publication Insurance Insider in 2008. In 2019, Mark launched The Voice of Insurance, which provides a platform for him to apply his unique experience, relationships, access, and understanding to bring his audience incisive and insightful global insurance audio content. Mark, it's great to speak to you today, and perhaps a rather odd situation to have a market journalist and an editor who I've known for so many years in the interview seat for a change.
Oh, well, it's nice to be interviewed. I mean, I just talk for a living these days.
Yeah, while many of our listeners will know you as a leading market commentator, both in print and I suppose more recently as a podcaster, what they might not know is that you actually began your career as an insurance broker. And I just wanted to get a sense from you of how you initially came to the insurance sector and also then what triggered the switch or the move into journalism.
I always wanted to be a journalist, but I had this conflict, and I think you had a bit of a clue in your intro. Madrid was the clue. So I was a Spanish graduate and I really wanted to be a journalist and a writer because I'd always sort of been involved in that kind of thing. But then I had this conflict that I did a Spanish degree and I really wanted also to speak Spanish all day and live in Spain or live in Latin America. But when I graduated, the first thing I did was I thought, well, I better go and get a job and get some money. And I didn't have any more money. And I hadn't done anything about doing a postgraduate diploma in journalism, which a lot of people have said that, oh, that was a really good idea. You should have done that. I didn't do it. So I just sort of went through the milk round. And the first thing, you know, this time, in the autumn, I found myself up and down Lime Street, but working for the biggest insurance broker in Spain that had a Lloyd's broker. It was called Gili Carvajal. And I worked for them for 7 years. And I also worked for Heath in Madrid. So I was kind of, I came back to London to work for Gili Carvajal, which is now Aon. And then Aon took over Gili Carvajal. That was around year 1999-2000 when there was a massive, the last huge wave of broker consolidation when Aon was really becoming that global broker and Marsh was doing the same thing. And they were just outbidding each other on different things and taking Spain, taking France, taking Italy. And, you know, all the brokers in London were being taken over as well. And so for me, I was just getting married to a Spaniard. So, who I'm still married to 25 years later. And so I got Spanish at home at that point. So I thought, well, this is the time. I was being offered redundancy or a chance to go and sort of punch my way around everybody else in Devonshire Square at the time. So actually, it was a good point to reassess my full commitment to insurance. I found it really interesting because, you know, it was great working in London, doing all the weird and wonderful. It was everything that couldn't be done by the Spanish, by the biggest broker in Spain, would send it to London, you know, weird contingencies, whatever, and all the hardcore stuff. And I had a huge amount of interest being one of three or four placing brokers in London who was seeing all this weird and wonderful stuff that was coming across the desk. So I would, you know, broker multi-classes. And then I'd worked in Spain as well. So I'd done it from the production side. I'd done it from that other side. But this gave me that chance to say, well, I've got Spanish at home now. I don't need a bilingual job anymore. So because the conflict was that you can't really do journalism in my Spanish is really good, but it'd be hard for me to write a Spanish article with the same nuance that I can in English. And so, that after about seven and a bit years, this was the time, and I had the offer of a redundancy check, and that just gave me the Dutch courage to go and try and become a journalist.
So when did you actually enter the insurance fold, as it were?
So it's 2005. 2005, it was Reinsurance Magazine, which was part of Incisive Media, which was the business that owned Post Magazine and Insurance Age that UK listeners will know all about. And it was absolutely the right thing to have done because, you know, the best thing about being a journalist is that you know, get rid of all the day-to-day stuff. You get rid of boring things. Obviously, if something's boring, then why would you write about it? If something's not new or it's not news, then you don't have to write about it. And so journalism's perfect for someone like me. And then insurance, journalism's perfect because insurance is so interesting, because there's practically everything that's on the 10 o'clock news can be, has an insurance angle. So I just took off for me. And then that was when, and that insider was around. And then, but by the time 2005, when you were at Global Reinsurance, you know, I was doing Reinsurance Magazine, had been around forever. And the insider had come of age at that point. It was starting to be quite grown up and doing lots of quite hard hitting stuff. And so it was one of those things, you move around in this big press pack and you get to know each other. And I think when they kind of finally knocked on the door, it was really easy to say yes. And then that was really great. And that was 11 years. And so, and then now the podcast is completely different, but that was over 3 years ago now. Yeah.
Just on that point there, of course, you know, we were aware of you coming into the market at the time. You were a new journalist. You were somebody that we quickly found out obviously had that background in insurance and reinsurance broking. Did that put you in a slightly different position, I suppose, when it came to actually interviewing people within the marketplace? Because of your knowledge and because of your sort of more granular insight, did that perhaps give people a, I don't know, whether it's a greater level of apprehension or perhaps reassurance when you were doing your interviews?
Well, not with the practitioners at all. It works really well because it just relaxes them straight away, because their biggest fear often is, particularly, you know, if you send a junior reporter to something, you know, to see a CEO, you slightly worry as an editor, you think, are they ready to do this? So you immediately know, oh, it's Mark. Oh, God, well, I can say all this stuff and I can talk in all the jargon that I'm used to. I don't have to double explain everything. And also, even when you meet someone new in insurance, particularly at our level of insurance, at this global wholesale specialty reinsurance world is really quite small. And, you know, they talk about 6 degrees of separation between everybody and the planet, but in insurance, it's 1 degree. So all you have to do is say, you kind of run through someone's seat, you've never met them before, you sit down, you're trying to make them comfortable and get them comfortable with you. We know each other, that we can relax, and I can talk and I can say TLAs, and you know, I can use all the three-letter abbreviations, and Mark will understand, and then he'll put them back into plain English when we go into print, so they can relax. And generally, it was really good.
Did you find that level of reassurance that they had then perhaps made them open up a little bit more in the conversations?
Oh God, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, that used to happen. That got me into trouble, and probably some of my interviews ease into trouble early days, actually, just because they forgot they were talking to a journalist. They just thought, oh, it's just this broker guy, isn't it? And that's the greatest thing about insurance is, you know, hadn't walked down Lime Street for 6 years. And then I walked down Lime Street as a journalist to go to the Lloyd's results, one of my first things I did. And someone bumped into me. Of course they bumped into me, you know, with a slipcase under their arm. They said, oh, Mark, I haven't seen you around for a while. Like, which broker are you working for now? And it's like, no, I'm not a broker. You know, because that continuity is just like, you've got a face, people recognize you, and they just assume you're still in the industry. And actually, I think that's, you know, that's really helped. I think it's helped, you know, that the journalistic standards are really so much better. That was 17 years ago. I think the insurance industry, I mean, you know, it's pretty lucky to be quite so well scrutinized. Maybe it wouldn't want to always be quite so well scrutinized, but scrutinized from a really high level of understanding these days. Now the bar's been set pretty high, and you know, that's only good. That can only be good, you know, to have someone really looking at you who really understands, and then doesn't go off half cocked all the time. Of course, because, you know, the insurance industry has a really hard time when it gets into the mainstream media. There's always this sort of, you know, like with the pandemic, it becomes very bad headlines. Why are they rejecting this claim? They've paid all these premiums, but no, people who don't really understand the intention of what those policies were, you know, we weren't privy to the conversations. It's very, very difficult. And obviously you didn't see the insurance press really criticizing the industry during that period.
And of course, now you have the Voice of Insurance platform. What do you think this platform now gives you or enables you to do that perhaps you couldn't do in previous roles as a journalist or as an editor?
It's really interesting because the Insurance Insider was, you know, it's that exclusive news platform, and that's a, you know, investigative journalism. And this is completely different. you can't doorstep someone on a podcast because it won't be much of a podcast if they just slam the door in your face. So it's consensual, and it's completely different. So it's on the record, it's consensual. You know, when you're investigative journalism, you're often having off the record conversations. It means that, you know, people are telling you things, but as long as you don't, it doesn't come back to them and their name doesn't appear in print as the source of the article. You know, you're doing all the sort of subterfuge. This is completely the opposite. It has to be transparent and open. And I thought, oh God, I wonder if that's going to work at all. But of course, it does work, because once you make someone really comfortable and you've also decided what you're going to talk about and what you can't talk about, it means that things that are on the agenda are really on the agenda. And that means you can go into the nth degree about them, and you can get into a really high level of understanding of things that you wouldn't necessarily always talk about. So it's just, yeah, it's difficult to have examples, but it's just a different feel of the whole thing, that you can go into lots of reasons. You can go into much more of the reasons why things are the way they are. And a lot of the more sort of shades of gray in between all the different black and white, you know, investigative journalism can be very black and white, whereas real life is much more nuanced. And so with this, with the consent of the person I'm interviewing, hopefully we go into those details. We go into everything in much more detail and much more, you know, you get a lot more of a feel for what it's really like.
And you get more of a sense of engagement, I suppose, with the person that you're speaking to.
You find out what they're like as well, because you can sort of fake it, but you know, you can do as much media training as you want, but when you've been on a line with someone for, when you know, when you're face to face with someone for 45 minutes, you know, at some point you're just going to be yourself, because that's the only way you can do it. You can't just pretend to be this persona that you've got. You just have to be yourself. And so you do get to hear what people are like. I think you can hear it in their voice, you know. So it's funny, you get that personal connection with people, and obviously that's something really intimate about podcasts. And so it's nice that you're sort of talking in someone's head while I don't know what people are doing while they're listening to this, but there you go. It's that kind of thing. It's quite radio, you know. Spoken word is really, really, you know, kind of intimate, isn't it? People feel they can know that person a bit better. I think it's better than video, and much better than in print.
At this point, I just wanted to switch tack slightly, because I wanted to get, I suppose, your perspective, that perspective that you have, which you get from perhaps operating on a different viewing platform on the London market itself. And I just wanted to talk about, or get your views on the market. How would you say the London market is currently positioned when we consider it in the context of the global insurance market?
I think it's in a really good place, because it's in a realistic place. And it's not, you know, when I was working as a broker, it's nice to be able to say that. I don't say that very often anymore. I used to say it all the time when I first started. But when I was working as a broker, you know, you were in Madrid and the people in London, you know, you send something to London and it comes back with all this sort of jargon and clever stuff. But they thought they were the only show in town 30 years ago. And 40 years ago, they probably were. By 30, they certainly weren't. 50 years ago, they definitely were. 40 years ago, they had a competition, but they probably didn't realize that they had a competition. And being a broker in London, you know, during a hard market, you go into Lloyd's, and sometimes people are so rude to you. You know, this is their distribution network, and they're being rude to you. That is nowhere near the case anymore. There's a huge sense of humility, and perhaps since all the London Matters report, of understanding where does the butter come from that goes on the bread, and how do we access this? And there's been a really good mindset change in terms of, you know, there is no more arrogance, and that's not to say that you know, that the London market's brilliant, but it's a very, very important change. And that, whether, you know, on a technical level, on the admin level, and on other things, and on commission levels and expense levels, there's a huge amount of work to do. But the most important step that has been made already is to realize that we're in a competitive business and we need to improve. There's, you know, a lot of technical work that needs to be done to improve customer service, to improve things. But I think the most positive thing is it's that mindset. Before, people didn't even know there was a problem. That it's in so much a better place now. And so that really bodes well for the future, because it's still relevant, it's still needed. And the more, you know, and I think with a lot of the technological developments, they're really difficult. I think people forget how hard they are. I remember when the electronic claim file was coming in, getting rid of loss notifications, you know, manual ones that was put in a van and sent down to Chatham and stamped and then some come back again. You know, all the nonsense that you would have to go through. But the thing says there's an interesting problem that the technologists think it's really easy. And it turns out, and actually, and of course, the insurance people keep saying it's really hard. And actually, it is quite hard. But the funny thing was when the ECF came in, I remember exchanging, which was now obviously evolved into DXC over different takeovers. But back in the day, exchanging was running the bureau. And they were saying, you know, ECF, people just said it's a glorified PDF. And they said, yeah, it really is a glorified PDF. But I tell you what, Adobe came to us because we had broken the PDF, the Acrobat document. You know, this is the PDF that we all know and love and hate. Well, the ECF just sending, you know, a couple of 100,000 PDFs around the market, it broke the PDF. So don't tell me that technology is easy because, you know, so Adobe had to send their most senior engineers to stop the PDF from breaking every time you split it up into whatever they were doing. And all they were doing was sending an advice on what was a glorified PDF. But that's it. So it shows that sometimes the technologists are very blue sky. And I think we're finally getting to a place where everyone's meeting a bit more in the middle. And so it's kind of six of one and a half dozen the other, which has really stymied the industry for 30 years. And finally, it's happening. And of course, you keep realizing how hard it is, you know, with these different blueprints and visions. And it takes time, but when the prize is really fantastic. So I'm optimistic it'll get there. You know, we're getting there, but and bit by bit by bit by bit. But it's going to take so much longer than people think. But when it happens, then the acceleration can happen really fast after that. And then a lot of those changes that people thought would never happen could happen really, really, really fast. And you could suddenly change that. But it's best not to talk about those things yet because it's too far ahead.
You touched upon a point there, which I think sort of links quite nicely into this sort of this idea of pursuing better together. And it's this idea of together, because I assume, you know, given what the market is trying to achieve, the scale and the scope of what it's trying to achieve, it must be done in a collaborative way.
Yeah, it has to. You both have to win, don't you? I mean, you've got to make it easy for the broker, and the broker's going to make it easy for you, and you both win because broker's margins should probably go up. And so should yours, you know, so should the carriers in the end, you know, and your customers have got to be really happy. I mean, you can make focus on making the customers really happy and then share the spoils afterwards, because the more happy customers you've got, the better business you've got, you know, instead of being a, you know, £60 billion market, the London market could be 120, 180 really quickly. And that's the prize. I mean, that's the prize. It's just, oh, wow, I can't believe that we sweated to do 60 and now we can do 120, 180, 240, you know, quite easily without, and we don't have to suddenly go you know, hit a load of buffers and hire thousands of new people. Actually, we just need to sort of, you know, rent a bit more cloud space.
Do you think the changes that are taking place at the moment will, I suppose, change the unique identity which the London market currently has? Or maybe that needs to change. Maybe it's market identity needs to evolve. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I remember when I was in that hiatus between being an insurance broker and being an insurance journalist, I had 5 years, and one of the things I was doing was investment journalism. And a stockbroker telling me about the, you know, back in the day when there was still an open outcry stock exchange, you know, on Threadneedle Street. You know, he said one of the things he missed was you could see when the market was on a run, you know, someone was holding a load of stock. They were a market maker. They were holding a load of stock in whatever it was, and it was falling and it was falling and it was falling all morning. And you could see they were putting on a brave face, but you could see they were starting to get scared. By tea time, it's, you know, nearly close, and they're holding a load of stock that no one wants, and that they bought it for this price and it's now 20% down, you know. You can see the fear in someone's eyes. And that's one of the things that you really want to be able to keep, you know, that. But I don't think we'll lose that. And as long as we have a place where you can aggregate business really quickly, you can go and get a $1 billion limit really fast with a few lines. And obviously with some of these follow syndicates, you can build, you have a big leader, you know, probably an arch lead or so, you know, someone who's a recognized leader in something, and bang. You know, if you can get follow capacity of $500-600 million, so within 3 milliseconds behind that, You know, that is a fantastic service. And that's the sort of thing you can only do within the London Market Framework. If that means that the London Market Framework becomes a global framework, you know, because if you can access that directly from Chile, you know, that's for something for a London only wholesale broker to worry about. But they really aren't that many of them. And the ones that, and, you know, we don't need to worry about, they're becoming global wholesale brokers anyway. And if they add enough value and they're really responsive, why would, you know, just because you can access something from Chile doesn't mean you would, because what if it's a class you don't really know much about, you want to have a bit of handholding, you know, if it's, say, you know, it's a bit of specie or something that comes through your door and you only do one of those a year, you want to talk to an expert, you know, that's what that wholesale expertise is all about. It's not just, you know, so no one's going to cut out someone if they're adding value and they're real experts. It's like, oh man, I'm so glad that, you know, because I don't know what to say to my client, this brilliant client I've got, I know all the vanilla business that I do with them, and they've got this, they've suddenly bought themselves a Picasso and they want to transport it up into the mountains. It's like, oh my God, can you help me? I do not know what to do. And the local market doesn't know how to do it. You know, that's the real added value, isn't it? That's where it's like, oh, thank God for this slightly cranky guy in London who knows everything there is to know about fine art and Picasso's and whatever, you know, and exactly how to transport it and what to do with it and how to dehumidify it or whatever, you know. It's lovely. But so there, you know, I don't think you will lose that at all. There's absolutely no reason why you would lose that, and you would lose those relationships. And of course, you probably wouldn't do the actual negotiating face-to-face, but you might negotiate the lead terms face-to-face, but then you can place everything within 3 milliseconds after that. In a sort of Dutch auction or whatever, you know, it could be fantastic. It's so efficient and all done. And the cover notes all done. The debit notes are raised. Everything's done. And, you know, and you can start claiming on the policy, you know, as soon as it's done. That's the prize. I don't think we'll lose anything.
And just sort of touching upon this idea of pursuing better together again, of course, you know, pursuing better together is this idea that there is no real end point, that you're supposed constantly striving to improve your process, improve your practice. In the context of the London market, obviously it has built up a degree of momentum now, but of course the key is going to be how it maintains that momentum. And just to get your view on that, Mark, how do you see the market sort of building on the momentum that it's created today?
I suppose it's a culture change. I mean, everyone knows what could be better. If you've done it once, you know, if you've improved once, you can know you can do it again. So it's learning that language of how to improve and how to do it and how to, you know, you need to measure what you've got, and then you need to work out, be open to new ideas of how we could do it better and have the institutions there. You know, every company needs to have these fora and ways of rewarding and incentivizing people to do things better. It's about structures and the culture. If you get the culture in place, it will never end. Yes, you will always be improving. Because, you know, if you're able to consistently sort of get into a process of measuring, talking about the problems, making sure they're always aired, talking to your customers and your suppliers, it's so important, isn't it? And working and being always open to new potential suppliers and third-party suppliers in the market. You know, again, talking to all of them all the time, but it's tiring, isn't it? The incentive is that you're just going to be a better, you know, you guys, you're just going to be a better insurance company than everyone else. You're going to have better customers. You're going to have better loss ratios. You're all going to get better bonuses at the end of the year. You need all that incentive. And what more incentive do you need? You know, what, do much better than everyone else? That should be incentive enough, shouldn't it?
I have a final question for you, which is a question that we ask all of our guests on this podcast series. What would you say pursuing better together means to you?
Well, I suppose I'm a bit of a maverick. I'm just on my own. So I suppose I'm just trying to do better with my interviewees. What I've slowly learning is that you have to listen to them. You know, I can say all these questions, and it was an interview. You can have all your questions prepared and you've got a whole list of them in front of you. But what you can't do is end up like Cilla Black on Good Old Blind Date. Do you remember? It was contestant number one, question number one to contestant number one, question number one to contestant number two, question number one. This grid, it can't be a grid. It needs, because I can prepare all these questions anytime I want, but they're all on my own, sort of in my bedroom a week before. And then actually, you know, it's the no battle plan survives the first shots of war, as long as you're listening. Because otherwise, if I mean, I cringe when I listen back to some of the interviews and I think, I didn't realize that this person just said all this amazing stuff. And I just went to the second question and I should have pursued what they said, because obviously the job of interviewers is to listen and then to clarify. So say, did you mean this or did you mean that by what you just said? And then, you know, to explain and to challenge and say, what does that mean? What does that mean now? Oh, wow, I didn't know you did that. So what would that then mean for your business if you'd carried on doing that? I didn't know you were doing that. And so to follow the consequences and then to get to a secondary and a tertiary line of questioning that was not in the original script. It was not in the, and that's, for me, that's us doing better together would be to just do much better interviews where you really listen to what they're saying. And it's so hard. And I've been doing it for 17 years. I'm getting a bit better. But sometimes, you know, you just lose it, or they say something new and then you can't think of the consequences of what line of questioning should I do now? They've just said something really amazing. I had no idea they were going to say that. You know,
as you say, it's all to do with that level of engagement in the conversation with the individual as well, where you forget that it's the interview and you're simply engaging in a conversation and responding and reacting to what's being said, as opposed to sticking to the parameters of the original set of questions.
Exactly. And, you know, because you plan it all out and then you realize it all jumps around and you need to jump around. You need to react to what's in front of you. And so that's for me. So again, is that doing things better together, that, you know, well, react to what's in front of you and really pay attention to what's in front of you, because again, that's your customer. And that's probably a new product is sitting in there. So really pay attention. Then you'll have whole new classes of business.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, I think that's a great point to draw this conversation to a close, and a very positive statement as well. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today. You know, you're clearly as engaging as an interviewee as you are an interviewer. I hope that our conversation has given, I suppose, our audience a bit of an insight into both you as a long-standing market commentator, as well as, I suppose, your unique perspective on the London market itself and where it's going and what it could potentially achieve. I suppose all that is left for me is just to say a huge thank you on behalf of Arch for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.